Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. So check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code HFPOD for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code HFPOD for 20% off your order. Farmer owned, Vermont grown, Sunset Lake CBD.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, listeners. I want to tell you about a sponsor, Music Masters Collective. They're a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. Every week, they host different events, all with the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like Oteil Burbridge, Trouble No More, former members of The Band, Milk Carton Kids, Nikki Glaspie, Bill Frisell, Sean Colvin, and many more. This June, join the Fab Four, Joan Osborne, John Sebastian, Marshall Crenshaw, and a great group of faculty for the debut of Magical Mystery Camp. This all-inclusive, once-in-a-lifetime music vacation experience in the heart of the Catskills will be packed with nightly performances, workshops, speakers, song circles, open mics, and a lot more. If you're a performing musician at any level, bring your instrument. If you're a music lover, bring your good spirit. It's an amazing experience for individuals, friends, and couples alike. Registration is open, spots are filling up, so check it out soon. And scholarships are available. Check out magicalmysterycamp.com/helpingfriendly to learn more. Hello, this is the Helping Friendly Podcast. My name is RJ. I'm here with my co-hosts, Jonathan, Matt, and Brad. What's up, guys?
Hi.
Howdy, howdy.
It's a Brad gave a silent hi, which everyone will be able to hear. This is a special episode. We're back for our November 1995 collaboration with Under the Scales and Beyond the Pond. We are deep into our winter planning with these November shows. I'm planning. I'm wearing sweatshirts and like winter knit caps and patchwork pants from 1995 just to kind of get in the spirit. I know Matt has some special 1995 features for us, so. But this is fun because this fall tour, obviously, of 1995 spans months and months. But Brad and I saw our first shows in October. I know Jonathan saw some shows in November, and it's always fun to go back to these shows. These are amazing shows to go through, so I'm excited. What about you guys?
It's a pretty good band at this time.
Yeah.
Pretty good rock band.
People seem to gloss over and just go straight to December, but there's a lot of cool stuff in here.
Seriously, great stuff.
Great stuff.
I'm excited about it.
We're going to try to add to what Tom discussed last week with Brad Sands on Under the Scales, which I hope everyone heard. That was a fascinating conversation. And there's some stuff that I think we'll reference because there were a couple interesting things that they talked about that I didn't know before. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. I want to say, first, this is a kind of a historic moment for our country in that, like, there's been, whether you want us to just stay in our lane as podcasters or whatever, I think everyone agrees it's been a pretty wild 4 years, and I'm not going to stay in my lane as a podcaster in that it's been really, really chaotic and insane. And I was thinking today that 4 years ago, in November of 2016, first of all, I didn't even have my second and third kids yet. We hadn't even formed Osiris. Matt had yet to join our crew in a serious way. There was, I mean, Jonathan, you had been with us more or less from the beginning, as far as I can tell, but you know, there, this 4 years, it's been really, really long 4 years and really intense because at least for me, there's I got two more kids, I got a business. And also we got this president who now appears to be leaving soon, which is to me personally incredible. But I don't feel like we often look back and think about all the progress we've made as a show, which I think is I want to thank our listeners for just sticking with us and growing and telling your friends and continuing to come back, because I guess maybe we still would do this if we didn't have any listeners, but it's nice to have listeners and to have people who like what we're talking about. But it's been crazy, guys. Think about how much different it is now, even just for us as podcasters, than it was 4 years ago. It's pretty wild.
RJ, I think to answer your question, it's been a wonderful, fun project that's turned into something where we've met a bunch of people and made great friends, and we're lucky enough that other people listen, because I think you're right, we would have done it anyway, right, which is funny, but we're glad that other people can also enjoy it, and Matt and Jonathan enjoyed it so much that they're like, we can actually make it better, and we're like, you're right, you probably can. Yeah. So I'm glad that that's helped us out too.
I would say that both Jonathan and Matt came in and immediately made it better in different times. We're lucky. I feel very fortunate, as a person and as a podcaster today. The audience has grown. We have had amazing guests. We've had really fun sponsors. We launched this network that brought a lot more attention and people and collaboration. And you're right. That's something. I don't know. I got to launch a company during the Trump administration, and I probably those things are so separate in my mind, but you're right. It's interesting. It'll be interesting if in the future people will just skip it over. Those 4 years in America. Yeah. That was just a thing. Let's move on to then when things got normal again. But we're going to keep going no matter what, I think. What do you guys think about these beacon jams that have been going on?
I wound up not sharing this on the internet the other night during the show, but I was a little bit taken aback, and I know I always say on this show, there's people have different reasons for loving this music. They get different things out of it. But I was the second that they showed the logo and they had the droney intro starting, before the logo even went away on the screen, I was like, they're going to do Ghost of the Forest tonight. And I was so excited about it because of the shitty week that led up to it and all the stress and overeating and not sleeping and stuff. I was like, this is perfectly timed to be this kind of cathartic release for emotional release for everybody. And instantly I started seeing everybody on Twitter being like, oh God, why is he doing Ghost of the Forest this week? But can't he just play blissful upbeat jams and stuff to help us forget about everything, and now we have to actually think about our feelings? And it was so weird to me because I just for people to have that opposite reaction. I know RJ, you've talked a lot in the past about your sort of emotional connection to that material and everything. Did you feel the same way, or were you just kind of bored by it?
No, yeah, I was we get to see another Ghost of the Forest show. This is amazing. I mean, especially knowing that Trey is a constant tinkerer of music, right? It's never going to be exactly the same, and certainly since it's been a little while since we last saw it, and having the strings, I thought it was awesome. I thought it was really cool.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about the strings just a little bit more, because of course that stuff isn't part of the record, wasn't part of the shows that we saw, and Don Hart wrote all of these new scores and apparently was working on them right up till rehearsal. They're beautiful, as all his work seems to be. Those collaborations, his scores of Fish and Trey songs are terrific, and that alone made it worth seeing another Ghost of the Forest show. Though frankly, I never really thought I would see another Ghost of the Forest show, so I was glad to have that too.
And Matt, to your point, about the. Also just about the changing kind of interpretation of music. I remember I felt the Ghost of the Forest stuff so intensely, and it was a long time ago now that that tour happened. I mean, relative to, our lives at this point. And it hit me in a totally different way. Just in the, couple of years that have passed. I don't know. It's interesting how that, because it's not just going back to listen to a 2018 Fish show. It's a it's a capsule, you know what I mean? It's like its own thing that I think changes over time for different people. So I think, I don't know what's going to happen over the next several shows of the Beacon Jams. Brad, do you have any thoughts about things that you think might be coming from the Beacon Jams?
No, not really. I mean, they've taken Paige out of the equation. So we know the four-man Fish isn't going to happen. And then Fishman last Friday, I don't know if he'll be back, but that may have been his appearance. I mean, we've got another month, I guess, till the end of this month, November. But maybe Mike, but to me, that's not something Mike wants to do. Maybe he'll show up. I don't know. But I would guess that there's going to be some horns at some point. I know that's kind of an easy guess, but with all the strings and all of Tab, that would be my next logical conclusion, I guess.
So I'm going to counter something you just said. I don't think there's going to be horns at any point.
God damn it.
So one of the things that I've heard from different horn players that I know is there's a lot of talk in the kind of brass and woodwind community right now about people not playing together because you're essentially projecting your spit out into the air.
It's like screaming through an instrument, basically.
Exactly. Right? And so the one thing I will say is that somebody, I guess it was Drew Hitz the other night during the show, said something about like, yeah, we're all kind of not playing together right now because of that thing. And Don Hart actually chimed in and was like, yeah, that's sort of the working assumption right now. So
yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
It seems like that's why they went with strings to augment the band instead of the horns, because it's a much safer option.
It would be awesome. They could spread them out through the balcony. Like
yeah. Beacon, just room, you know what I mean? Room sounds.
Yeah. Trey clones in the balcony playing horns.
All right. Well, real quick, before we continue on to the show, Jonathan, can you just tell us about the song that you released this past week? So that people can know about it?
Sure. So I put out another song. It's a new song. It's called Deal You Sue. It's kind of a country-ish ballad. I would say I was leaning more towards like a Grant Parsons kind of vibe than maybe a pure country. But I hooked up with an old friend of mine named Ben Taylor, who has played with a number of bands around over the years, and I've known him since grade school, and sent it to him, and he liked it, got the vibe I was headed for, and put together some players and produced the track for me, and it sounds pretty great, and it is on my Bandcamp.
And we should link to that. I remember you sent me an acoustic version of it, just you playing acoustic guitar. Was that like maybe April?
Yeah, probably. That would be
a long, long time ago.
Takes time. We had a little pause in between in the process while due to COVID.
Yeah.
And then finally he was able to get a pedal steel player in, and the guy laid some keyboards on there too, and yeah, rounded it out real nice.
Yeah. It's awesome. And I said a long time ago, cause it's just like, it's been a long time in the works, and I know you spent a lot of time on it. So I want people to be able to check it out.
Thank you.
And I want to tell you guys about one podcast episode that we think you'll enjoy. We'll put a link in the show notes, but the Talk House podcast, which you all may be familiar with, it's typically two musicians kind of interviewing each other. And we're friends with those guys, and they have an episode coming out this week with Mike Gordon and Leo Kaki. And I think everyone who's listening to this will enjoy it. I haven't heard the episode yet, but I've heard that they talk, of course, about their collaborations. Bob Weir, and Mike talks about Bob Weir and what he learned from Bob Weir about rock and roll. Apparently they talk about the mind-opening book that Trey recommends to his bandmates, and a bunch of other stuff too. So should be a good conversation, and we'll put a link in the show notes, and hope you all check out that show. All right, guys, let's talk about November 1995. I mentioned at the beginning that this is another collaboration with Under the Scales and Beyond the Pond. Next week, you'll hear Beyond the Pond talking about one of the jams that we will absolutely mention, and we'll double back to that. But November 1995 was an incredible month, I guess, to me, first of all, because it, you know, starts right after the Halloween cover of The Who. But Matt, what was going on with Fish at this time musically from your perspective?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things, and I highly recommend, if you haven't listened to it already, go and listen to the episode of Under the Scales that came out last week with Brad Sands, because Tom and Brad did a great job of talking about kind of what some of the big tentpole items were in Fish's world at that point. But one of them, of course, is Jerry Garcia having died, and sort of possibly being an influx of people coming from Dead Tour onto Phish Tour. Although that may not have actually been a driver for this tour, because as Brad pointed out, the dates were already booked when Jerry died. But the other thing is the Quadrophenia Halloween, and that has historically been linked to the growth in size of the venues, because Phish was now playing arenas all the time, and they played this, you know, album by one of the greatest arena rock bands of all time. And it may have kind of, as other Halloween albums have influenced their sound, this may have been the one that sort of helped them grow their sound to fill those rooms, make them sound a little bit better. And there's some elements that we'll talk about, I think, throughout the conversation here that are sort of marquees of 95, but that seemed to be kind of like the driving force, is like bigger rooms, bigger rock and roll sound, maybe a little less nuance in the jamming, and trying to kind of make the sound in the room work together. And then also kind of having this opportunity to play in front of, you know, bigger crowds consistently than they had ever before. And I think, you know, spoiler alert, we'll probably find that they really seized the moment, and this led to kind of their growth through the second half of the 90s.
So Jonathan, you as a Grateful Dead fan and podcaster, I mean, to be fair, we're all Grateful Dead fans, but you are representative of the Grateful Dead fan in this discussion. So tell us, okay, so you saw shows this tour, but you also had seen the Dead. And I guess my question for you is, do you think that the music was kind of affected by that, particularly because you saw some Summer 95 shows, and I know you're a big fan of Summer 95. Do you see a difference between summer and fall? And do you think any of that had to do with either the passing of the torch figuratively or the people showing up, or like, is that factor in, or is it all just kind of a happenstance of history?
You know, I don't know. And I think maybe Brad talks a little bit more and has a little more knowledge about what might've been going on in the band's, you know, in the band room conversations and in their heads. But as a listener, to me, this just feels like an extension. To me, Summer 95 feels like an extension of Fall 94. Fall 95 feels like an extension of Summer 95. They were growing and threading this line that you can, I mean, to me, because I wasn't seeing every single show at the time, and you couldn't, you know, like nowadays, you couldn't hear every show the day after or whatever. So to me, it was kind of a constant rise from the year before and the shows I'd heard prior to that. The band was just continually getting better. And I didn't think that the musically it had anything to do with the shifting dynamics in the audience. I definitely saw shifting dynamics in the audience. There were just more people. There were people that I had never seen before. But Phish had been growing their audience very organically for years. So I think you can only assign partial credit to Grateful Dead influx. I mean, I had tickets to Grateful Dead in September of 95. I didn't go see Grateful Dead, but I didn't just suddenly go see Phish those weeks either. So
right.
I did have Phish tickets for the fall though, but they were in October and they were in November rather, and they were in December.
Yeah.
But other people surely did. I don't know.
Brad, this is when we first started seeing Phish, and this was like the beginning. As far as I'm concerned, this is like, you know, this tour is what Phish sounds like live, you know, because it was kind of the first thing I heard. But going back to these shows from November, any revelations for you or thoughts back to when you first started seeing and listening to the live stuff?
No, you know, I obviously mentioned that it was our first show just a few days before, you know, before the month of November started on 10/28. And that was at the Palace. I mean, just a huge arena, 20,000 plus in that place. And it's funny because they were doing Acoustic Army then, even though they were expanding. So they were still kind of holding on to this, you know, quieter sound, I guess, while also trying to figure out how to play these huge arenas. I mean, they rocked the place when we saw them, obviously, at the Palace. And I think they continued to do that through November. You know, I think it all, it was a huge, 95 Halloween, I think, was a huge turning point, as all the Halloweens were. But the month of November that we're going into, I think, directly plays off of that 10/30/195 show at the Rosemont.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think the it's interesting, the Acoustic Army, because that is it's such a contrast. And I remember getting the tapes, you know, we'd get the fall 95 tapes and like the tapers just like, you know, they'd crank up that one section and mm-hmm. then, you know, try to like drown out the audience noise, but still hear the acoustic. It's just like, it seemed like a conscious fish thing to kind of fuck with people. But especially because the amphitheater ones, I think, are a little bit easier to, as a taper, I've never taped, but it seems like it might be a little easier with outdoors than like when you're indoors and there's like, you know, suddenly it's like four acoustic guitars and then, but there's still people going nuts. Interesting. I feel like I haven't really heard that many Acoustic Armies except for the ones that are on Live Fish, because like on the tapes, they didn't really show up.
No, they don't. And they're hard to hear. And it's one of the, I don't know, something that I didn't look forward to, you know, with tapes back then, with bad recordings. But it's funny, the transfer from amphitheaters that you mentioned to these big arenas, they this is kind of a preview though. I think they changed their sound from that summer 95, those sweet jams, those very exploratory kind of jazzy almost dissonance. And then they are transitioning, and I think we'll hear it all throughout the month of November, from that sound to the bigger rock, not so intricate, as you mentioned, jams in November. I'm excited.
So we decided that we would each pick a jam, and because we can't go through like every show, with respect for, you know, everyone's lives, but we will, we're going to post the playlist. I know that I said I would make a playlist for a previous episode, then I did it like a week later, but we have the playlist. You can see it in the show notes. You can see what we all listened to. We all went through and listened to a bunch of jams, but we're going to highlight four jams, one that each of us chose, but talk about some other highlights along the way. I guess, you know, one of the things that Brad Sands talked about was just the break between Halloween and those Fox Theater shows. And I remember getting the Fox Theater tapes because it was fairly rare to get. I mean, I got six tapes at once, you know, it's pretty sweet from three shows. Like a three night run was pretty rare. And to get all those tapes, you know, maybe I got them in December or something. It was such a beautiful like gift, you know, there's like three new shows in the mail. And we don't have to go through each show, but I thought the playing in each of those three shows was really good. And Jonathan pointed out that you pointed out the Reba in the first night of the Fox, but did you have any thoughts about how those three shows started, Jonathan, for this month?
I mean, they played a great tour in October, you know, and then they worked their asses off all the whole time to get through this Quadrophenia thing. And they took this well-deserved break and they come out and they just play really, really well. Yeah, the first thing I played when we were like, all right, November 95, let's get into it, it was Reba from the first show of the tour, of the month, rather. And it's great. It is exactly what you'd expect from this era. It is just really well-played, dynamic, beautiful. And I think you get that throughout this run.
There are a few gems, I think, that we could all agree on, like jam vehicles from fall 95, at least from this month. It seems like the mics and the tweezers and the, you know, You Enjoy Myself and the Bowies really are like, it's kind of where everything is, with one notable exception that everyone kind of knows about. But do you see a big difference between like the mics from the third night of Atlanta 11/11 and like the super psychedelic summer 95 jams? Like, Jonathan, you kind of described it as an evolution from summer to fall. To me, they sound so much, They do seem evolved, but they seem a little more like focused than like the Mud Island Tweezer and the Jones Beach Bowie and some of those ones that got way out there. Matt, do you see it like that, or please tell me if you see it very differently?
No, I definitely do. I think, as I've said before, for me, from summer and fall 94 through fall 95, it seems like they kind of refined their approach a little bit each time. Like 94, they're just like digging and digging and trying whatever they can. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And it's all very weird and interesting. Summer 95, they're still taking that approach, but they've kind of learned a little bit more how to find the interesting bits without kind of seeming aimless at time. And so you have something like the Mud Island Tweezer, which is very long, but it's very interesting the entire time. And it also is very musical the entire time. You don't get into a lot of like weird spaces where you could call it kind of like anti-musical or anything like that. I think by fall 95, you know, I don't know how much of this was them going back and saying, okay, we might have pushed the envelope a little bit too far with all those like 40 minute jams versus adapting to the rooms, which I think is personally probably a bigger influence on the sound and what happened, because by this point they have played arenas enough, especially small arenas in 94, to understand what the what that experience is going to be like and maybe what some of the pitfalls are going to be. And so they're kind of reacting to, like, you know, maybe doing playing things where we're all playing these really crazy different polyrhythmic parts doesn't sound good in the room to the audience, but also to the band, because you got to, you were very correct a second ago when you talked about amphitheaters versus arenas. Like, it's not just the muddiness of the room that affects the audience. There's also this slapback that happens from the sound hitting the back wall of the arena and coming back to the band. And I think they really learned how to play that. They have to put more space between the notes, which playing the Who album really gave them great experience doing that, because it's this big, chordy, chunky, riffy rock. But then also, you know, people talk about the percussion rig that Trey had as like this way for him to get out of his own way and sort of give space to Page in particular to kind of take the lead and you know, drive the jam forward a little bit more. I actually hear it, and I didn't have this revelation until we listened to so much of this month. I think a lot of it is him kind of trying to reinforce the downbeat a lot of times and kind of like give them more rhythmic coherence and almost play the room a little bit to kind of, you know, like not have them drifting away from the rhythm at all, or like, you know, fish can be very busy at times, but to just like get in there and reinforce this like boom, 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 and kind of get the audience and the band all in one place and work the room a little bit better.
Jonathan, you saw both summer and fall shows. Do you feel like a big difference going back to them? Like, this 11-11 mics seems to be the first, like, I mean, there's a lot of jamming in that those three shows, but that to me was like the first one that got super out there.
I mean, it's different, but every show, every tour is different. So I kind of bristle when you say more focused, because I think they are, nothing they're doing in these several years and this time is without focus and without utmost focus.
Fair.
And I think that they are, you know, but I think Matt may be onto something. I actually tend to agree that they are driving for different things, playing off the room, feeling that slap back. I think that's a very important point. So, you know, you're going to get different sounds doing that, and you're going to wander into different corners. One of the things that Fish, once they really started improvising, has, you know, collectively on stage, has really done very well is not repeat itself. And so that this is just more of, we're continuing to jam, we're getting weird, but we're not doing it the way we did last time, because that's not who they are.
That's a good, really good point. And I was actually just, you guys know I do interviews for this other podcast, Past, Present, Future Live. And I almost feel like Fish taught me this, but I feel like now I realize that this is actually most musicians, because I've had a lot of people on that show that I've talked to about their career. And as you get further along, you hear people talk about how they don't want to go backwards. And like, if you grew up as a music fan, like listening to classic rock and, you know, music that you just hear repetitively, you sort of assume that there's like that bands just like kind of play all their songs all the time and just like play the same songs all the time, you know. But once you like start listening to musicians talk about it, there's always, with most really good musicians, I think there's like this always pushing forward, right? And I feel like I learned that from Fish, and I'm sure the Dead was the same way. I know Miles Davis, that was like one of his main things, but it's interesting that you frame it that way, Jonathan, because I think I'm sure that's what they were thinking, right? They're continuing to challenge themselves and continuing to push themselves forward, which I think is notable, you know? So I feel like there's an arc to this tour. I feel like the first few shows, four or five shows, are really good, and then there's like a little bit of a dip, and then it kind of comes back toward the end, and I'm curious if you guys think that, but I feel like this 11-12 show, after they finished the three nights in Atlanta, they go to Gainesville, and there were just some, I felt, really good, kind of more, I don't know, they just, maybe a little bit more patient jams. The Reba, certainly, and the Tweezer in this show, I thought were just really pretty stunning. It felt like they were kind of, even though they came out of the gate hot in Atlanta, I think they started to kind of settle down a little bit. I don't know if you guys feel that way, but I feel like this show kind of was, this show and the next show were sort of like these kind of like they were reaching peak kind of like patience. And this Tweezer, I think, is a good example of that.
Yeah. I feel a little bit differently than you. I think the Fox shows were just okay. Now that's just okay by fall 95 standards, which means that they're freaking awesome. But compared to everything else, or a lot of what we'll hear from this month, they took a week off and I think they had to kind of reconnect. The other thing is it doesn't get talked about enough. The irony of them, you know, playing this Halloween, which was supposedly the big christening into Arena Rock. And then they go and play three nights at the theaters as the next shows. So they're like, they're swinging big in a small room. And there's great stuff. The Reba from the first night is awesome. The Hood from the second night is really, really great. I think this was one of their last opportunities to really play to a smaller room and take advantage of, like, you know, like in a Bowie or Hood jam, dropping to like absolutely near silence and then building it up from there, which once they're full time in arenas, they don't do quite as much. Like the bottom of that dynamic growth is a little bit higher because they still have, like, you know, anywhere from 7 to 20,000 people in front of them. So it doesn't play quite as well. But I think you're right. I mean, and the other thing, I mean, just to look at the tour, which is actually kind of crazy to think about today, they spent almost a week in Florida.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so weird. It's so crazy. Yeah.
No, I was going to say, and we have to remember, we're kind of isolating November. They were playing in September through October, you know, and then they play December as well, obviously. So they've been playing for a while. This is our focus, but, you know, the arc that you were talking about, RJ, is actually longer, right? The fall is an incredible fall. We don't see them anymore. And this is really... Yeah, obviously, the end of the 90s, they toured a lot as well, but we got to remember the beginning of the 90s is when they were playing so many shows, hundreds of shows, so they're used to this long arcs of tours. But I wanted to mention about the Fox, as we'll be talking about YEM later. I don't call it YEM, YEM later. The second night of the Fox was the first of, I think, about five YEMs out of these 15 or so shows in November. And it contained that Crossroads, which you highlight in the playlist, RJ, the intro and outro of the Crossroads within the middle of that YEM. They do that a lot throughout the month of November and probably the other ones, but that's kind of the focus of YEM, is these middle sections where they play another song or at least quote one. So that's the highlight of those three shows, I think, for me.
Hey, why don't we take a quick break to hear from some of our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
What is a city without its music?
The legacy of the New York Philharmonic
is incredible. Nearly two centuries of history. That's a lot of music and a lot of stories.
I was sitting on stage for the very first time thinking, I can't quite believe this is happening.
Join me, Jamie Bernstein, as we explore the history of the New York Philharmonic. It's the NY Phil Story Made in New York, a podcast about a city, its people, and their orchestra. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
They go from the Fox, which is about 5,000 cap, to the what is called the O Dome, the O'Connell Center in Gainesville, which is just funny to me because I'm a child, which is 10,000. So they're doubling the size of the room in you know, one night, basically, without any, like, time off. They're, like, going to a double. I mean, I just feel like that doesn't happen with bands very frequently. Maybe for some that are in transition, but to go from a 4,000 or 5,000-seat theater into a 10,000-seat arena seems like a big shift, although I guess they had been doing that in October as well.
Yeah, and for the past couple of years before that, I mean, they were, you know, big room, little room, and it was so much if it was regional, but, you know, now that's, like, more consistently edging up towards the big rooms.
And this Tweezer, I think, is just, I mentioned the kind of patience, but there's a bliss and a kind of a, but I don't know, I still don't really know what hose means in the context of Fish, but there's some blissful guitar playing. I need to study it more, but there's some blissful jamming in this Tweezer. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I'll say about this tweezer. I think it's nice and stretchy. I wouldn't call it laid back, but it's not really propulsive. It just kind of goes, and there is a really pretty segment in the middle. It's kind of like a Beatles-ish kind of progression, if the Beatles jammed, I guess. And there's the part right near the end, it starts to step up, and like they could have gone into Walk Away, but they back off of that. And it's a nice tweezer.
I think the two things about 95 tweezers, and particularly fall 95 tweezers, as opposed to every other era of the band playing this song, it's much more driving rock song than a funk song. I mean, if you know, it started out as this funk groove. They build it up towards this, and then, you know, a year later, they'll be back towards more of the rhythmic, funky thing. So much of that is caused by the way that Fish plays the drum beat. In 95, he has this driving rhythm, you know, four on the floor kind of rhythm on the ride, that he's just sort of propelling things forward and keeping the groove really, really tight. Part of that may be that room sound thing, just to try and tighten things up and make it a little bit easier for the band to hear and kind of get into. And then Dre's playing as well, particularly when they start the jams out, it's more riff rock than like a funk thing where he would play sort of a lot of like nine chords and stuff like that. And you don't hear it before or after. It's just kind of a relic of this era, but obviously it created so many great tweezers like this one. And another great example that we've talked about in the past is the one from a month later in New Haven, where it's just like a driving rock song. But it's great. And these 95 tweezers are just kind of magical.
So there's the next show, which is the most popular show of this month, Jonathan. I feel like this doesn't happen that much with Fish, but probably more than I am willing to acknowledge, where it just feels like it's just going into this space that's completely unplanned, completely organic, but like completely innovative. That happens in this show. But let's talk about the 14th quickly. And I will say before you do that, Beyond the Pond will be talking about this segment that Jonathan will be talking about, I'm sure. But they'll be doing that next week for their episode. But Jonathan, what makes this show so amazing?
Well, I mean, I don't even have the whole set list in front of me. I've listened to the show a million times, and I don't remember the set list beyond, like, really the Stash, Manteca Stash, Dogface Boy block, which of course is heavily dissected. It's an official release and all that, but I get chills like every time when you get to that heavily chorded bit and the early in the Stash jam, and it just gets heavier and darker, and I can hear it in my brain right now. Yeah. I've listened to it many times. I made this hour long Stash mix years ago, and it features that prominently, this bit where I can hear it. It's so great. It is one of my top 20 favorite bits of Fish music. It's just fucking awesome.
Well, so, okay, thank you for that, because this only happens actually a couple times in Fall 95, in my opinion. There's also the segment from Live Fish 1, which is the 12-14 show with the Haleys and ICU Slave. Like, I feel like that's a similar thing where it's just like they're in this space that's just like unplanned but completely original, and it feels like you're part of a ride that like they didn't even really know they were on until they were playing it, which I think in this point that got more common sort of later on as they became more comfortable just exploring these spaces. But this does feel like a very special kind of moment of this tour. Matt, do you feel similarly to Jonathan? Is this a special one for you?
Oh, totally. Probably maybe my favorite jam or segment of into all of Fall 95, other than some parts of Binghamton. It's amazing. You can watch this. There's video of it from when Live Fish was still selling videos a little over a decade ago that has, made its way onto YouTube. So you can check it out. Visually, it's so cool to watch because there's a lot going on. But yeah, I mean, it's amazing. And I actually would almost call this like the... I think there's a little bit of an analog to like the Providence Bowie. And like, this is like the stash version of the Providence Bowie, where it has all these different sections. It's very scary at times. It goes to lots of different places. And when they finish it, it just feels triumphant. Like the band was like kind of unexpectedly, you know, went to these places, as you said. So it's, I'm sure most people have probably heard that, but if you haven't, especially before our friends, Brian and Dave, talk about it next week, go ahead and consume this jam over and over again, because it's pretty amazing.
Also, you know, a nice example of something they did a lot on this tour, which is land from some serious, serious shit into Dogface Boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was going to say that, Brad, like there's, like with so many of these jams that we remember, they're like, there's just something, you know, kind of not necessarily silly, but just something very like fishy in the middle. That's like, of course they play Dogface Boy in the middle of this like intense jam. It's like, you know, the Lassie stuff in the Providence Bowie or whatever. They can't just like do a psychedelic scary thing in this era without like just some goofing around.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me of, my second show was a 12/8/95 show in Cleveland. And they played a Tweezer Kong, and I was like, this is just silly shit, you know, so crazy and so weird. But at the same time, in the moment, and even with this stash, after the moment, it's still pretty intense and still can take you to some crazy places, especially depending on where you are mentally. Right. So I also got to mention the second set ends with the YEM immigrant song jam back into YEM. Just to highlight the month of YEMs here, that goes on. And again, I'm sure everybody's heard it. This is a well listened to live fish release for me, at least.
Well, but I don't know that everyone, I think like everyone listens to that segment, but I don't know, maybe people listen, like you said, Jonathan, I don't really remember the whole set list. I've listened to it a ton, but it's so focused on that one jam segment that the other parts might get overlooked.
I would say though, kind of to contradict my own self and maybe a little bit you, is that
it's good radio.
Thank you.
I think I'm really contradicting you, is that that the jamming that they do in this is, they're doing this all through this entire tour, but this one is one of those that crystallizes into something that is like just perfect. It is the target. But there's a lot of out there jamming on these shows. We're going to get into some more of it.
Okay, so I have a theory, because I think Brad Sands mentioned that this was like, at least based on his memory, this 11/14 show was not hugely, it wasn't, I don't think it was a full arena. And you look at the routing, and like you look at like going from Gainesville to Orlando and then to Tampa for the next night, it's a little bit of a triangle. Like I could, cause you, if you leave, and this is getting into, you know, some serious conspiracy theory stuff, but it's sort of like, you know, the Vegas show from 98. I mean, the show after the Vegas show, 98, they got kind of passed over because they, people just went on to the next stop. And you could see leaving Gainesville, going down 75 to Tampa, go to the beach, you know, and miss this kind of Orlando show, which is a little bit out of the way Tuesday night. And I don't know. I do think there's some credence to this like off night thing.
There could be, but I'm doing, you know, fish tour in Florida in 95. I'm going to do all three shows. I mean, that's just,
but what if you wanted to get, wacky. What if you wanted to get to the beach in November, man?
Far more likely to have skipped Florida altogether, to be honest.
That's a good call right there.
Why wouldn't you want to go to Disney World instead? I mean, going to Disney World in the middle of fish tour sounds like a lot of fun. And though Florida is quite large, we're still talking about one state. I mean, there's a big difference between that and like skipping Utah to get from Vegas to Denver, which I could certainly see some people doing even today.
Fair. Okay, fine. Let's put that conspiracy.
And there was a day off. They're 13th. They could go to the beach on the 13th. Right,
I'm creating conspiracies that we're then disputing, right, disproving immediately, which is always fun. All right, so they go on to Tampa and West Palm Beach, both okay shows. The West Palm Beach show, I think, is notable because there's like, and Brad Sands talked about this a little bit, there's like the Butch Trucks sit in on one song and then Jimmy Buffett on another song, and apparently they were trying to visit both of them and different. I mean, it sounds kind of crazy, but. I know we all hold Jimmy Buffett in very high regard, as an artist, a songwriter, and a performer, especially Matt. I know you love Jimmy Buffett, and Jonathan, you do too. You guys have been on tour with him, right?
Fins to the left or whatever. I don't know.
You should see the look Jonathan's giving me right now.
Parrot. They're both parrot faces, aren't they?
I will deny going to any Jimmy Buffett concerts, but I will stop right there.
The Butch Trucks sit-in is like very awkward because he's playing a song that he doesn't know, he's never heard. And as Brad Sands pointed out in the Under the Scales thing, he's basically just playing One Way Out, and Fish is trying to adapt Possum to be that.
They escape Florida after that encore. I feel like they just jumped in the bus and were like, we're out of here. And they end up in Charleston, North Charleston, where they still play shows today, which is... This was their first show at this North Charleston Coliseum, and they most recently played there in December of 2019. Have you guys seen a show there at that arena? Yeah, I haven't either, but it seems like a pretty good place for Fish, and this was their first stop. I know Brad has some particular thoughts about this show, but this seems like, you know, a couple of days off and kind of getting on the road again kind of refreshed them a little bit, because this is it's a pretty solid show.
Yeah, I love it. Number one, I love Charleston, the city. I think it's a gem in the southeast or whatever, and it's just a wonderful place to be. We each kind of picked a jam to focus on, and I've been talking about the YEMs, obviously, but this is the one that I focused on the most. I thought it was great. I've listened to it a few times after listening to it, you know, all these shows once. It comes out of a really, I think, fun first set. Has a lot of things that would draw my eye. You know, on a J card, that first set and the second set with the bag opener, I think is great. Free is really new at this point. Just came, you know, they just started playing it, in spring of 95. So, again, a good, both first and second sets are good. But this YEM is 30 minutes, I think. Well, 25 minutes if you take out the unnecessary vocal jam at the end, but, the 25 minutes, 25-minute jam is they go in and out of Brick House. They tease it a bunch. They quote it a bunch. They don't label it on Fish, on .NET or Livefish, I don't think. But Brick House is in there, and they jam it, and Trey sings the vocals. But this is, I think, one of the incredible YEMs of the five that are played this month. I think they're all really well played. You know, it's a very composed song, and I think maybe that's why it doesn't get a lot of attention. I'm not saying it should get a lot of attention, but it's an awesome, when well played, it's 15, 20, 25 minutes of a really fun, danceable song. And this, I think this version really highlights, you know, I've got some notes, but I won't belabor the point.
Jonathan, besides the unnecessary vocal jam, do you also love this version?
God damn it. I am going to quit this fucking podcast.
I'm also on team vocal jam.
Vocal jam is part of you enjoying myself.
Yes.
It is part of you enjoying myself. I'm pretty sure the band will stand up against you too. So you can say it's 2-2, but
they're not on this podcast.
Yeah, but
oh, I didn't know that.
But without them, no.
What about Sneakin' Sally? I mean, is that part of Sneakin' Sally?
The vocal technically no, because they didn't write it, but it is part of their arrangement.
Okay, all right.
You and Joel Myself Vocal Jam is very cool, but more importantly, the Brick House move is super slick and graceful, lot like the Crossroads, the Immigrant Song, the other things that that Brad has already kindly pointed out to us. But I think it's rad. I think that if you want to deep dive into You Enjoy Myself, you owe it to yourself to go to the fish.net review archive and pull up Charlie Dirksen's You Enjoy Myself reviews and follow along, because he makes a lot of salient points about how they are different, even though it is, as Brad correctly notes, you know, very composed song. You know, they definitely, you know, emphasize different portions of it. Mike's solo gets a little pretty melodic in this one. You know, Nirvana bit gets a little weirder in this particular one. And yeah, it's a good one.
I'll also point this one is exciting. There's no real Trey. You know, they each have their own little sections. Each band member usually starts with Paige or Trey, but Trey doesn't take one necessarily. Maybe the Brick House portion, you could say he drives, but at the end, Fish, I'm assuming Trey's on the mini kit, because it sounds like there's three people drumming at the end of this jam, and it's really awesome. It's really fun to listen to. It sounds
Fish is definitely two of those people.
That's what I'm saying. Right, exactly. Maybe he might be all three, but I think Trey might be one of them. Probably is one of them. So it's a great version.
Matt, was this the last golden age for You Enjoy Myself? Fall 95.
I don't think it's the last golden age for Yem, because I think they continued to play the shit out of it for a long time after that, up to and including in 2.0. But I do think that 95 is one of the only eras when you do see things happen that you wouldn't otherwise see in other places. So like when I was, you know, to your guys' point a second ago, I think we're mostly in agreement, like as opposed to like something like Tweezer, where it's like, you know, 3 minutes of composed and then who the hell knows what's going to happen. You know, most of the time, if they play You Enjoy Myself, you know what's going to happen. There's variations. Maybe the Nirvana is a little longer. Maybe Trey's solo is more or less fiery. But it's like it's very consistent in length, around 23 minutes, because they tend to do kind of the same things each time. But here comes 95. We listened to this November 18th version, and it gets to, you know, there's some cool things throughout, like they do some bird whistling in the Nirvana section, and there's some neat things that happen throughout. But then, like, you get to the natural drum and bass ending of the song about, you know, 16, 17 minutes in, and then it's like, okay, they're going to do that, and then they're going to do the vocal jam. And Mike sounds like he's winding up to, you know, finish his part and go into the vocal jam, but here comes Trey on the percussion kit, and they managed to juice another like 13 minutes out of the jam because of that. And you see that in these Fall 95 Yems, you know, the most famous version being Albany, where it's like the thing could totally be over, and then it's like here comes another 10 minute section of like drum madness and stuff before they have to go back into the drum and bass section to end it. So, and I think this is the last time, or maybe one of the only times, when you see things like that happening on a pretty regular basis.
Matt pointed out the bird whistling. This is the second time we'll mention the Providence Bowie in this episode.
Drink.
Yep.
That's what I was referring to when I mentioned the weirdness in the Nirvana section.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Speaking of drink, we are going to take a quick break to hear from some of our sponsors, and we're going to come back after that and break down the rest of these shows. We are back. We are still here. It's still 2020, as far as we know. But we're going back to 95, and we are jumping back in at the 11:19 show, which, Charlotte, I think there's another really, really good Tweezer here. The Tweezers have been just phenomenal this tour.
Theme 2001, Curtain, Tweezer, Billy Breathes. Come on.
And Life on Mars, which I just like to take this moment to talk about how often they played Life on Mars on this tour, which is more than zero. And I really, really wish they'd played it for one of the shows that I saw, or maybe one of the shows that I will see one day again in the future when we have shows, please.
I've never seen it. Have you seen it, Jonathan?
No. And it's like the only song that I actively, willfully chased at this point.
Kind of amazing how much they played it in 95 and 96. And then it's like once a few other times. I mean, it's amazing.
Great
cover. Well, I do think this tweezer is totally different from the one we talked about from Gainesville, in that it's much more, I guess, Jonathan, like you said that other one wasn't kind of like propulsive. This one is.
Yeah.
Which is cool. You hear a lot of different kind of jamming. And I think that's something that's different from 94 Fish, right? They're, in 95, like they had the ability to diversify in these jams in a way that I think was probably started in summer 95, but you didn't really hear that in fall 94. You heard the tweezers were very, like the good ones were very good tweezers, but they were all kind of similar. It started to diversify so much jam-wise.
I wouldn't call it repulsive, but yeah, I get it. But the Mule, I thought the Mule stuck out too. I'm not a huge fan of Son of the Mule, but I thought it was a little bit different than this show generally deserves a listen.
All right, so they, Winston-Salem, once they get there, then shit starts popping off, as the kids say. The first set, there's some acoustic stuff in the first set. And Jonathan, I don't think they were doing that on every, like, why were they playing like Long Journey Home and I'm Blue and Lonesome in the middle of the first set? But they didn't really do that in other places, I guess, because they were just feeling it in North Carolina.
Yeah, they're just feeling it, I think, because, you know, it comes back. They do it again a few shows later. Those songs were very much in the mix. I was fortunate enough to see that pairing, actually, later in the tour.
It seems like at this point they were treating the bluegrass thing almost like another flavor of the acapella thing, where it's like something, or even by this point, the Fishman thing, where it's like a trick that they do that they can put into shows. They don't do it every time. It's a little unexpected, but they always have it in their back pocket, as opposed to like 94 when they were doing it all the time, or like in the earlier 90s, they were doing, you know, acapella tunes almost every night. Personally, I'm all for an alternate history or alternate reality or dimension or whatever, where they still do that, like, you know, maybe like three or four times a tour. Do the bluegrass thing. But because they did it, you know, they did it on Halloween, they did it here, they did it at Shoreline as a tribute to Jerry at the beginning of the tour. So it pops up, you know, sporadically.
But Matt, there is this segment in the second set, which I believe is what you chose here to focus on, a pretty wild, I don't know, first 30, 40 minutes of the set.
Yeah, this is my selection for the jam to talk about. Is very representative of what was going on here. It's Simple into Bowie, and they wind up playing a little bit of Take Me to the River, and then back into Bowie. And there's so many things going on here. We should probably listen to a little bit of it just to get a flavor.
Thank you.
So, I mean, just kind of rapid fire some things to unpack here as I was doing some detailed listening on this. And you know, we played a little segment of it, but you should really check out this entire sequence because there's some cool stuff going on. But in the simple, you know, the Trey gets to the percussion rig instantly in this simple jam, and they wind up having this cool little jam. You know, once again, I feel like this is one of the areas where, like, he's trying to reinforce the rhythm and kind of get things rocking inside of this big arena. The thing about the, you know, we talked about how this is kind of a way to tighten up the sound in the room. But it's also like, at times I think that there's a, it's a signal from Trey, to the band to do something. So like when we get to the end of when he finishes wanting to play Take Me to the River, which is basically just like one verse and chorus, he kind of does a couple quick hits on the percussion rig and the band very quickly pivots back into Bowie. So I wonder if there was some sort of unspoken tricks or signals to each other that he was like, hey, if I do this, like that means, like, you know, go back to where we came from or something like that. This is one of the only eras when I think you could see a smooth segue, a complete segue. The not just the alligator, as my friend Jimmy likes to call it, but the dash in the alligator, true segue into Bowie. I mean, like, how do you jam into that song, right? Well, this is a great example of it. Like, the hi-hat intro starts, it kind of gets into some spookiness, and Paige is doing some weird things. So that's very, very cool and something to listen for. In 95, if they went to a weird or kind of ambient space, there was still some sort of driving rhythmic aspect to it, whether it was Trey kind of still playing on the percussion as with the Orlando stash, or Paige would still be playing some staccato, you know, triads or something like that. You know, there was something, and in a matter of like a year or two later, they would learn to remove all of that and have it just be a wall of ambient sound, which is really cool. But you don't have that in 95. You know, case in point here, you've got 5 minutes of Bowie intro with weird stuff going on, but it still has like drive, you know, percussive elements scattered throughout. But then like Bowie in 95, I think my overall takeaway is that like it relies a lot less on the big build from this pianississimo up to a fortissimo, which kind of, you know, gives it this really amazing trajectory.
What to what now?
Fortissimo, fortissimo, like super, super loud. I'm using music terms, man. You know,
I felt like
shit.
So the
Brad's asleep. Brad, wake up.
He's talking.
Sorry, keep going, man.
You know, I mentioned this earlier. It's like, you know, I wonder if like playing in the arenas, they felt like they couldn't drop the bottom out quite as much and go to a quieter sound to build it back up. Because they don't do it as much here. And the Bowies in 95 are more about like balls to the wall for during the jamming and how much they can kind of exceed your expectations about how far they can take that. So like, this is a perfect example because like, you don't even see the peak of the jam coming because they're going so hard. So hard, and somehow telepathically, Trey decides to go to the high E, and Mike goes to the A minor, B minor, C progression that ends the song at the same time. I listened to it like 5 times this afternoon, and I couldn't, even having heard it just a minute before, I couldn't guess where that was going to happen, because they're just going forward and forward and forward and forward.
So it's funny that you said all of that about the dynamics, because I did you read my note? Because I find it interesting, you know, I listened to this segment and I completely agree that the mini kit gives us the simple, you know, the jam and simple is all driven when Trey goes to the mini kit. And the Bowie intro is really long and groovy. But this whole, the simple jam into the Bowie with the long intro, into the Take Me to the River, to me, that is all about the dynamics, the quiet to the loud to the back and forth. They ping pong a good bit. But then, yeah, then they blow in out of Take Me to the River, back into Bowie, and then it's just hot, high tension right up to the wire and right up to the end. And it's really sick. It's a really, really great passage of music.
Matt, I appreciate that detailed kind of breakdown, because that's an intense like segment of music. And I think to listen to the whole thing as one passage is like, it's a commitment. And I think it's good to like put that whole thing together, you know? I have a question though. Why is it Take Me to the River, but not Brick House a few nights earlier? Like, I know that Phish.net has their own methodology for this, but this was, like you said, Matt, wasn't it a verse in a chorus? Don't go there.
Yeah, they didn't mention they didn't label Brick House.
It is labeled on .net. It's noted as a jam. There's a Brick House jam.
But why isn't it into Brick House?
I think the difference is that like they never completely switch over as an entire band to playing Brick House. Like it's basically just like Trey playing the Brick House guitar part and singing the lyrics over a Yem jam. This is kind of the same thing as did they play Party Time thing. It's like, It sounds a little similar, and Trey's singing Party Time. That doesn't make it Party Time because Fishman's not actually playing the drum beat to Party Time.
I think Brad and I, because we don't really know much about music, actually, we're right. Like, well, he said Party Time. I mean, what else do you want him to do? You know,
Party Time.
Imagine if they stayed in the E minor, the spooky Bowie key, and Trey was just on top of that going like, take me to the river. That would be more of a tease, where it's here like they actually as a band pivot to playing the song for a little while.
I hate when you bring up logical things that make sense. Pisses me off.
Yeah, but my counter argument to that is that they tease the music. The Trey plays the little riff of Brick House during that, and then maybe 2 or 3 minutes later, the whole band is playing it, including the bass line at least, and then Trey starts singing it. So there's even like an intro to it in that. So that would be my argument, and that's what I would stamp and then send to .net.
And please, please make a donation to the Mockingbird Foundation. Jonathan, the next night they go to Landover, Maryland, the US Air Arena, which was the Cap Center,
Cap Center. US Air Arena is what people from other towns call that place. It's the Cap Center.
Ooh.
Cap Center. They go to the Cap Center, which Brad Sands again talked about. And I know the Dead played a lot of shows there, and that's sort of a hallowed place for jam bands. But Jonathan, this is the first show of this tour that you saw. When you got there, were there people talking about this Winston-Salem show from the night before? Was there like a, was it feeling like the tour was picking up steam of some kind, or what do you remember going into that show expecting?
Well, I checked my diary, and no,
sweet.
I don't keep a diary. I honestly don't
thought
remember.
We just stumbled upon a huge huge breakthrough. Like, Jonathan has a diary.
I had some friends who were doing the shows, and so yeah, you know, people were like, oh yeah, they did this and this, and I was excited to be there, and you know, I was with my girlfriend and my buddy Joel, and we had seats on Page side, on the side, but so all like the very first row on the side, which was basically one step up on a riser on the floor, halfway back the floor, which was reserve seats, and it was rad. We had all this dancing room. It was a fun ass show. So I'm sure some people were like all a buzz about what had been going on in the recent shows, and we got a little bit of that, but forgot all about it. The show to me was really good. The first set is really solid, and then they come out for the second set and completely botch Rift. And just abandon it and go into Free. And it's like a 30-some minute Free. And it's
amazing.
Sick. It's sick.
Amazing.
And it was just a great, just fun thing. And yeah.
The free is the noteworthy point of this show. I will say that back to .net, the jam chart entry for the Antelope, which is an early first set Antelope, says the jam wastes no time dicking around, but gets right into the intensive and dissonant playing. So, you know, there's no dicking around in the Antelope, but there wasn't a lot of dicking around in general in '95. They got straight to the point. But that 30-minute Free is certainly, and then you get another You Enjoy Myself in the second set, because it's like everyone gets a You Enjoy Myself on this tour, which is amazing.
Yeah, and we got a Slow Poor Heart.
which I feel part. Like is worth mentioning.
Do you guys think that anyone got yelled at for the tour, for the rooting of this when they went from outside of DC up to Pittsburgh and then back down to Hampton after just having come from Winston-Salem? It just feels like a little bit of a, you're like, what the fuck? Why are we going all the way back up to Pittsburgh and then all the
I'm
way
sure
back
Brad
down?
Got yelled at. That's what happens, right?
It had,
in general,
I could tell you it had everything to do with the nights of the week and ticket sales and Thanksgiving. So Thanksgiving was after Cap Center. And so they went to Pennsylvania. I know Brad talked about it. You know, they had Thanksgiving up there.
Excuses.
I think it was Pennsylvania or New York. I don't know where the hell they had Thanksgiving. It's not my meal.
Probably Jersey.
Yeah. But then they played Pittsburgh on Friday. And for years, I was like, man, I should have gone to Pittsburgh. I don't even have a real reason why. But, you know, then we went to Hampton the next night. So
I think if you're Fish in 95, you don't really get to have whatever tour routing you want.
Right.
You know, Oasis and REM and bands like that get to, at this point, pick where they're going to play and when. Fish is trying to wedge stuff in. They still are not that well known, and they've got to work around, you know, college sports schedules, NHL, NBA, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, beggars can't be choosers, right?
I guess not. All right. Well, anyways, Brad, I'm sorry that you did that. But then they go back to Hampton, and Jonathan, this is your pick. You were at this show as well. You made the smart decision to avoid the horrible routing and went straight to Hampton.
So this show was rad. It was nice to be back at the Hampton Coliseum. I'd seen a few other shows there. And so I was excited to see Fish's first show there. And they came out and opened with Poor Heart, which was fun. And having just seen the slow Poor Heart, we were surprised to see the fast Poor Heart. And the first set's really good. It doesn't, you know, go deep necessarily. But then second set, they come out blazing with this timber that is perfect and excellent and everything you want from a timber hoe. And as it ends, they just go into this weird, as usual, Kung and then Mike's song. And so to me, you know, you mentioned this at the beginning, RJ, that, you know, one of the banner jam vehicles or what have you of this tour is Mike's song. And this is one of those. This is just great. It's perfectly excellent Mike song, and except that they have a rotation jam in it. So at one point, you know, Trey goes to the mini kit, and then he wanders over to the drum kit. Fish gets up, walks over, and takes Mike's bass from him. Mike goes to the guitar, and then they rotate again with Mike with Fish going over to the guitar. And that's always a trip because Fish is not a guitar player. And then Fish ends up, it's basically removing Fishman around the stage. He ends up on piano, and then everybody ends up on piano. And they had been doing keyboard cavalry on this tour. And so a lot of people wrote it down as keyboard cavalry because unless you had seen it, you didn't know that keyboard cavalry, what it was. You just knew that it meant everybody was playing piano. But here, they did not play keyboard cavalry. They improvised, and frankly, is weirder and much better for it for the rest of us. they just push themselves just so far out there. It sounds a little like chaos, and then they just round the corner, and everybody goes back to their place, and they finish Mike's song and completely slay the finish on Mike's song. It is outstanding.
Thank you.
then we get that that bluegrass section again. We get My Long Journey Home, which at the time I would always write down as $2 bill because I love that song. And I'm Blue, I'm Lonesome. Just, God, I love 95 Fish. And then they did we have to mention the Poor Heart thing. They closed set two with the slow Poor Heart, and they played the weird, even slower Poor Heart or reprise or whatever you want to call it to open the encore for a minute. And, well, God, Fish is a weird-ass band.
First of 21 Hampton Coliseum shows to date. Hopefully,
this
was
the very first?
But this is the first, and it's, what a storied venue. I mean, there was that huge, huge dump they took on in 04, but besides that, it's been such a beautiful venue for Fish. Matt, do you have any comments on the Rotation Jam, John?
John.
No, Philly's later in the tour.
I think it's it works better than a lot of other Rotation Jams. I think that they tried to my ears at least, they tried to make this as musical as they could, though it does kind of get off the rails a couple times. Whereas like other times, like the Spectrum 96 or what was the one that we just the Virginia Beach 97, anything like that, it very, very quickly gets into like weird territory, and they're cool with it, right? They're just like, let's make this sound weird. Whereas like, I think they legitimately were trying to, in this jam, be like, hey, let's see what happens. Like, can we actually jam if we're on each other's instruments?
The first ever. I mean, that's what .NET says.
Yeah. And Brad Sands mentioned I think he said something like Rotation Jam could get really interesting depending who was on which instrument, there's a ranking of each person on each instrument. I don't know it offhand, but there's definitely like preferred combos and unpreferred combos, but yeah, really cool. And an awesome way to kind of, continue this tour. I mean, I can't believe that they played, what was it, like a few days in September, almost all of October, almost all of November, almost all of December, and almost all the shows are worth going back to, It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's an incredible tour. We're going to wind it down because there's a few shows left, but we should stop in Nashville on the 29th and say that they played with Bela Fleck, and that I think is, I remember getting those tapes, and I remember, you always remember the tapes you get with like the characters, whether it's like an asterisk or an at symbol or whatever, with all the, notations. Those are always memorable. And this was one that, I'm sure, Jonathan, you've listened to with a lot of the second set with Bela Fleck, which is, not necessarily a revisited, show in terms of jams, but kind of a cool moment.
Yeah, it's, I mean, Bela Fleck, he's rad. The dude could really play. And in the era, we were all pretty hip to him, I think. Those, at least my circle, and him coming out with Fish was just, hell yeah. And yeah. I listened to this tape a lot in the 90s.
I would say the second set closer, Slave with Bela on banjo, is is really cool and that definitely worth listening to. But that was interesting. I guess if you stop in Nashville and you have those connections, you might as well get Bela Fleck out to hang out. And we should say that the latest Eric Krasno Plus One has Bela Fleck on as the guest. Matt edited that just a couple hours ago, I think.
Yesterday, yeah, it's one of my favorite episodes. Fantastic discussion between those guys.
Sweet. All right, so this is completely not a coincidence that the next show, the last show of November, was the very first episode of the Helping Friendly podcast, and later, I think after Kevin Shapiro listened to episode one 6 years later, made it a live Fish archival release in 2019. But this is
I've never heard it myself.
Yeah, no one did until they listened to episode one of the Helping Friendly podcast, which you'll have to work hard to find. And is the sound quality is incredible.
Yeah, you can find it. We'll send you a CD. Yeah, I want to see the notes from that episode. I know we had
it on
one
mini disc.
I think you had a lot of mental notes in that one, Brad. But I would say that the sound quality on episode one of the Helping Friendly podcast is only very, very slightly worse than the sound quality of what you're listening to now. But anyway, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about this last show of November 11:30. this is a really, really, really cool show start to finish. I think this is like a kind of a quintessential 95 show. I might be biased, but I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think you're biased, but it's good. I will say this is mostly for your benefit, RJ, but everybody else out there probably gets something from it. The notes on the jam chart for the tweezer are, this is what the hose is all about. So there you go, RJ.
Okay, I'm going to go listen to it again.
I want more Hood standalone encores. I think that's what I take away from this. Just that's it. Just one, yeah.
I think there's something to your point about this being sort of like the, you know, archetypical 95 show, because up until this show was released on Live Fish, there were no set list notes on this show at all. And now the only note is this show is available on livefish.com. When this show came out on Live Fish, I looked at the set list. I'd never heard it before. And I was like, this seems like a kind of an unremarkable show. Usually there's like something interesting beyond the playing, but then you get into it and it's like, it's a fantastic show. And kind of to my point about the Atlanta shows at the start of the month, there's nothing necessarily standout versus any of the shows. It just kicks ass from start to finish.
Brad, why did we choose this as the first show? Because your wife's from Dayton?
I think that was like one of the things I pointed out. I think we wanted an Ohio show for sure, right? And yeah. And we didn't want to go to scientific. Something. We didn't want to go to something that was, you know, the 97 Nutter show. So, that's all I got. I honestly don't remember.
I think it was about the tweezer, because this tweezer is, as they say, this is the hose, as I've always defined it anyway. And it's a great jam, but it's some of these shows in the you know, 94 to 96 era, like, it's all about the tweezer. So guys, any reflections after we kind of went through all the stuff on this month?
I want to go back. Actually, the truth is, on Sunday, the 26th of November, 1995, is the day that I learned I was going to be a dad. So, this month holds a lot for me.
Wow.
And the music is part of that. So these are great.
Amazing.
So I think when I reflect on this, I was just thinking about like expanding on what I said earlier about like they spent a week in Florida, right? The bigger picture there is they spend an entire month essentially touring the Southeast, which like these days would be like maybe two cities, maybe they do one or two nights in each. And I was trying to think about like the impact that would have. Obviously, like playing more shows, are, you know, we all know this. The more they play, the better they are. The more fun they're having on stage, the more connected they are. But like, it feels to me like the stakes are lower at each show if you're covering so much ground in a geographic area, because it's like, you know, let's say on like a modern tour, the only place they were playing in the Southeast was like two or three nights in the Atlanta area, right? If they kind of whiff a little bit, that's a lot of people who maybe that's the only stop on the tour they're going to see or something like that, that are kind of disappointed. And it can also have a huge bearing on the momentum of the tour, which is like, as opposed to, you know, if you maybe don't show up completely in like Gainesville and you play Orlando the next night, it's like, whatever, man. You know, like we did that. We're playing a new place, and we have a fresh start, and there's not as many people who are kind of impacted by, you know, a lackluster show. I've got to think that takes some of the pressure off. And this is me just projecting, but I wonder, you know, if that had them feeling a little bit looser because each show only had so much kind of impact, plus easier for the fans to kind of go from place to place or like without going very far, see a whole bunch of, you know, shows within, you know, driving range of their home or something like that. So it's just interesting for me to look at that stuff. And then, of course, the other side of that is that then December, which everybody talks about, is when they go into the Northeast and the heat gets turned up a little bit. But that's a different show.
I think that's probably fair.
To support your points, Matt, number one, I think they're trying to spread their name a little more than they have to now, whereas they'll play one show in Florida, maybe go to North Charleston, or you know, I mean, they used to do New Year's a little bit in Miami, and they knew the place would be full. They know the place would be, you know, it's going to be filled. Whereas, you know, they go to Gainesville, and they're not going to fill the O-Dome. So let's go to a few more cities to try to make sure our name spreads a little more, I guess. So they're still trying to do that. But the other thing I'll add is that because they played so much, I like the fact that there's not pressure on them. I like that point, Matt. But also they've played so much that I think they think about it less. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
there's probably less thought into set lists, and it's notable that they didn't. I don't think they repeated a song at the Fox, which is a 3-night run, and something everybody would scream about now. Like, not scream about, but point out. You know, that. But they were doing it back then, and it wasn't an emphasis. It was just like, well, we've got all this material, we know it all really well. We're having a ton of fun. Let's do it. It's awesome that we separated this month from this really long fall winter tour. But there's so much within it. You know what I mean? It's not like you could separate each of these months and find a bunch to deal with. I want to point out that December 1st at the Hershey Park Arena is also a live Fish release, but it's one of my favorite live Fish release. And there's nothing really anything too special. Maybe the Colonel Forbin's and the Mockingbird, but it's one of I love going back to it. I think it's a buried alive opener for Jonathan, and I wish it were November 31st.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing to both of your points, that there was like there was an interesting kind of like looking at this in this very specific month takes away from this like massive tour. And I think when they're on this massive tour, to your point, I think both of you guys were saying similar thing in that just like, it's easier to just kind of let go and just kind of have fun, because also if they're playing between late September and late December, I don't know, 50 shows probably or something like that. I mean, they're just like, they probably weren't even thinking about what they were actually, you know, you're just playing, getting on the bus, you're going to the next place, you're playing, and they're getting better and better. And some nights are good, some nights are bad, but more people keep showing up. Like, it's sort of like it's an interesting thing about a long tour. Whereas now for a summer tour, you get 20 shows and it's like they show up on night one and it's like, not that they have anything to prove, but it's a different deal when you're like, you have a very limited number of shows to really like do what you want to do, you know?
Right.
All right. Well, this was really fun, guys. And for everyone listening, thank you so much for listening. You should give us a review on wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts or wherever. And we appreciate you all listening. We're going to have more cool stuff coming soon. We have actually some big announcements coming, so just stay tuned for that. If you're still listening, I will tell you a secret, which is that Brad's beard is as beautiful as ever, and is bigger than ever. But there are other announcements coming, so stay tuned. And thanks, everybody. See y'all soon. Keep on rocking.
Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Well, hey friends, my name is Zach Lupitin. You may know me from the band Dust Bowl Revival, but I also host a music discovery podcast called The Show on the Road. For the last 5 seasons, I've been able to dive deep and have intimate chats with folks like the Lumineers, Ani DeFranco, Wolf Peck, Keb Moe, Lake Street Dive, Bela Fleck, and more. So guess what? After 150 conversations with some of my favorite songwriters from around the world, we are bringing brand new episodes to the Osiris Network. New interviews and intimate acoustic performances will be coming at you this summer. And which episodes are coming next, you ask? Good
morning. I am Zach Goody, the lead singer for the band Smash Mouth.
Our band is called Milky Chance. We are based in Berlin.
My name is David Shaw. I sing and write songs with my band, The Revivalists.
Trust me, these conversations go some wild places. So subscribe to The Show on the Road on Osiris, and we'll see you soon. Again.